This is London Calling.
London Calling.
James, are you on a witch hunt, James Dellingpole?
I think you've persuaded a lot of gullible, well-meaning idiots to join your revolution, and they don't know what they're doing. But at its hard core, I would say that this is a very nasty extremist organization which engages in economic terrorism. And the damage you've caused to the livelihoods of Londoners and beyond, you've caused endless misery. Welcome to London Calling with me, James Dellingpole, and my very good friend, Mr. Toby Young. Tobes, you've been really busy recently, haven't you?
I've been very busy, yeah. Yesterday I was busy. I had to do a piece for The Telegraph, write my Spectator column. Then I had to do a Lockdown Skeptics update. I've got a lot of original material I've been publishing on Lockdown Skeptics recently. Yesterday I had to prep this paper by one quite senior professor.
It's really good.
Really good, yeah, yeah. Sort of essentially
one of the guys works in the pharmaceutical industry.
One of them works in the pharmaceutical industry as the VP for R&D or something at Pfizer. And another was an epidemiologist who works with the NHS. And they were essentially talking about the risks of false positives with the PCR test and the likelihood that the uptick in supposedly infectious cases, is in fact just a function of increased testing and increased false positives, and how there's really no risk of a second wave. And the NHS, if it starts now gearing up for an imaginary second wave and cancelling elective surgeries as a consequence, lots and lots of people are going to die unnecessarily.
Do you not fear that although there will be no second wave, I'm sure this paper is absolutely right, even though there won't be a real one, the government will be careful to engineer one. I'm thinking, for example, of Caerphilly in Wales, yes, which has just been declared a lockdown zone.
Yes.
And I know this because my sister lives just outside it, and she's breathed a huge sigh of relief. And it's purely a function of the fact that they set up a testing station in Caerphilly, I think, 5 days ago.
Yeah.
So it's no wonder they're suddenly finding more cases when they're testing cases in the area. It's just a con.
One of the, there seems to me very little doubt that the increase in the number of cases is entirely an artifact of increased testing.
Yeah.
And the reason increased testing produces more positive cases is not because there are positive cases out there. There are infectious people out there who are discovered when they increase the testing. It's because the testing itself produces false positives. And we know this, and we've known it for months. And one of the reasons it produces these false positives is because the test is far too sensitive. This was a point that Professor Carl Hennigan, Professor of Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford, made in a recent paper that was published, written by him and his team at the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine. They published it on Friday. It was a preprint, so it hasn't been peer-reviewed. But essentially, they reviewed 25 studies of the PCR test, and they found that often the PCR test is far too sensitive. So it will flag as positive people who've had the virus but make a complete recovery. So they've got traces of the virus, tiny fragments of the virus still in their system, even though they're no longer infectious and have made a complete recovery. And they're flagged as positive. And it's the identifying of those people, for the most part, in community testing, that is causing areas like Caerphilly to be placed under local lockdown. I mean,
does this mean, Tobes, that you and I didn't actually have coronavirus after all?
Well, no, I think we had it, James. But right. Interestingly, when I took my test, you're initially given the finger prick test. And if you test positive for antibodies, they send off a blood sample to the lab in Barcelona so you can get the Abbott test, which is the kind of gold standard and produces very few false positives. They do that because the finger prick test does produce some false positives. But interestingly, when they finger pricked me, I also tested positive for antigens as well as antibodies. So it was as though I had coronavirus
when
I was taking the test.
I had the same experience. They said to me, how recently did you have it? And I said, well, 3 months ago. And it says, yep. Well, it thinks you've still got it.
That's what exactly what they said to me. Yeah. And that's because the test is far too, I mean, even that test is far too sensitive and will flag people who've had it and recovered, like us, as positive, i.e. still infectious, and a reason to kind of, you know, quarantine. It's ridiculous. You know, had a government testing facility been giving us that test, they would have, you know, they would have said, okay, you've got to self-isolate now for 14 days. And we would have said, well, hang on a second. We had it 3 months ago. We've completely recovered. No, our tests say you've still got it. So you're going to have to isolate. You have to tell me everyone you've met in the past 3 months, because you might have passed it on to them.
I mean, yeah, that would really happen. I'd really do that.
Oh, James, you go
to
jail.
I'd be giving false numbers.
COVID martyr.
Signing myself Dr. Crippen and Mickey Mouse and things like that.
But yeah, it's a complete... It's just such a farce. And, you know, Matt Hancock has been out, you know, doing the round of television and radio studios, warning everyone about this alarming uptick in the number of cases on Sunday and now on Monday. You know, saying we now have to be extremely careful to avoid a second lockdown. You don't want to kill your granny, blah, blah, blah. I mean, he clearly just doesn't understand what's being tested for. And doesn't understand the risk of false positives and how you have to contextualize this raw data that he's getting. Yeah. Isn't capable of it. It's just kind of, you know, the same old song and dance about how, unless we're extra cautious, it'll be, you know, everyone on the naughty step.
I get why Matt Hancock behaves like this, because he's a man of clearly limited attention, intelligence, with a massive appetite for power. I mean, he came into government on the back of George Osborne's coattails, didn't he? He was Osborne's creature, and now he's risen, and the Frankenstein monster's gone out of control. I understand that. He's fixated with his track and test and trace nonsense, in the same way that Dan Andrews in Victoria is obsessed with eliminating every last case. What I don't get is why so many of Hancock's colleagues seem to be endorsing this utter bullshit. Why is he not being held to account? I know there's this notion of collective responsibility, but surely if the guy who's skippering the ship at that given moment is steering it smack bang into an iceberg, it's kind of your job, isn't it, as the second in command or the third in command, to say, hang on a second, there's an iceberg over there. It's going to sink this ship if you're not careful.
Well, I think it's the same old story. I think the government has decided that there'll be a lower political cost to pay if they are on the side of extreme caution. So even though second lockdowns, turning the NHS back into a COVID-only service and so on, even though that'll result in colossal collateral damage with countless unnecessary deaths, they think the political cost of that would be lower than relaxing, taking a more laissez-faire approach, not locking down again, not issuing these daily warnings, not adding countries to the quarantine red list on a daily basis now, not waiting till Thursdays. They think the cost of that, if it resulted in, you know, the NHS being overwhelmed, which I think they still believe is a genuine risk. I spoke to someone yesterday, James, a senior person within the NHS.
Yeah.
And I said, do the NHS brass, do the most senior managers in, yeah, this was in NHS England, do they really believe that in the absence of a second lockdown, that there is a real risk that the NHS will be overwhelmed, and that something like, you know, I think the original Imperial College prediction was that absent a lockdown, 500,000 people would die. About 40,000, yeah, 45,000 have died so far. So do they really think, you know, at the very highest levels in the NHS, that absent a lockdown, the NHS will be overwhelmed and 450,000 people, all those people that Neil Ferguson said would die and haven't yet died, will die by, you know, the end of this winter period, if there isn't a second lockdown, and if the NHS doesn't take these preparatory steps now and start cancelling elective surgeries, kicking people who can walk out of wards to clear beds for, you know, this surge of coronavirus patients. Do they really believe that? Answer, yes, they do. They actually still believe in the Imperial College prediction. They think, you know, it's only because we've been extremely cautious, locked down, keep locking down areas where there's a surge in infections like Leicester and Bradford and Oldham. It's only because we are taking these steps and people are, by and large, observing mask wearing and social distancing protocols that we haven't yet seen that 500,000 death toll. And there's still a risk we could see it because Neil Ferguson walks on water. He's infallible. Whatever he says is right. That's what they still think.
Wow.
And I think it's partly we discussed why they still think it, and it's partly anchoring bias. Once you've sort of committed yourself to an initial hypothesis, you're very reluctant to acknowledge that that hypothesis is wrong. One of the characteristics of clever people is that they're really good at rationalizing evidence that appears to completely contradict their position. You know, that's why so many of them are hard leftists. You know, why so many of them still embrace Marxist ideology in the face of overwhelming evidence that their hypothesis is false and runs aground when it comes into contact with reality. So in the face of all the overwhelming experimental evidence that, you know, COVID is not nearly as dangerous as we originally thought, they can't adjust. They don't want to abandon their original hypothesis, which they committed to and which they made important decisions on the basis of. And they're very good at rationalizing to themselves why they shouldn't abandon it. This
scary.
Is what's going on, I think. I don't think it's a, as this person I was talking to, worked at a pretty senior level in NHS England for many years, said, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think, you know, it's just a series of cock-ups. It's vanity. It's an inability to admit error. It's anchoring bias. It's rationalization. It's not a conspiracy because, as you and I know, Toby, he said, these people couldn't even conspire to make a sandwich. And he's right, James. You know, the people running NHS England, stick them all in a room and tell them to organize a coffee rota, you know, for who's going to get the coffee over the each day the following week. They couldn't do it. Yes. The idea that they could organize a global conspiracy, you know, which somehow benefits Bill Gates and various pharmaceutical, I mean, of course there's an element of self-interest in it and they don't want to rock the boat and so forth, but there is no kind of organized conscious conspiracy. They can't conspire to make a sandwich.
Yes. But I do find it slightly disturbing, Toby, that you can enter the mind of government like this. I think it's a bit like you being able to think like a paedophile does or like a serial killer does. And I think, I'm not sure it reflects very well on you.
But if you if you want to catch him, you got to find out, you got to know him, don't
I
you?
Suppose I mean, you have. Well,
I feel like an FBI profiler, James. In order to catch Hannibal. Son of Sam, I need to enter into his mindset.
Well, you've done it. You've done a freakishly good job. And I think you're probably right. I've been very unforgiving on Twitter today. The people who really annoy me. I expect bedwetting lunacy and stupidity from the left. I expect it from Remain voters and people like, you know, reptiles. And I like reptiles, people like that. But when I see people on my own side endorsing the Hancock rubbish, Ryan Bourne, for example, of the Cato Institute, you know, a libertarian think tank. Melanie Phillips, who used to be...
Couldn't believe Mad Mel. I mean, she's usually right about everything.
It's actually what bothers me about this, Tobes. It's not... Okay, so they've been gulled by the false statisticoids that have been put out by the medical establishment. I mean that's a relatively venial slip compared to the really bad thing they've done. They've failed to see one of the biggest grabs of people's freedom by governments in peacetime ever. And just gonna shrug their shoulders and go, well, if people like Matt Hancock and Dr. Fauci say it's and Dan Andrews say it's necessary, who am I to quibble with people being locked down at home and to quibble with them being quarantined just because they've gone to the wrong holiday resort where their chances of getting COVID are probably the same as if they'd stayed at home. This is what I don't get. Why isn't every single free market, liberty-loving, conservative type, why isn't everyone up in arms about this? We've gotten past the stage now where, oh, it's in the balance. We're really not sure what to think. There is so much evidence out there. Why aren't the newspapers turning round? Well, I mean, we know. Actually, my brother Dick gave me a very interesting insight into this. Dick's worked in the marketing stroke advertising industry all his career. And he points out that our print media is bought and paid for by the government. And he was talking about how nobody in the ad industry ever pays the full book rate for advertising. You know, a big advertising space in a newspaper might be 30 grand book rate, but will probably be negotiated down to sort of 6 grand or three. I mean, I the figures aren't exact, but you would pay a fraction of the book cost. The government is paying book cost every day and basically bailing out our newspapers, which rather otherwise be well on the way out, I imagine, given how few people want to read these things anymore. Actually, which gives me a sort of neat segue into another issue this week, which we were going to discuss, I know, which is Extinction Rebellion's blockade of the newspapers.
Yes.
And there were lots of articles on the subject. I mean, you know, Douglas Murray wrote one. Who else wrote one? Quite a few people wrote these boilerplate articles about this is an attack on our free press. They asked, you cannot silence free speech. This is the wrong way to go about it. And I was thinking, yeah, sort of, kind of. I sympathise with that argument, having spent the first 25 years of my working life working in Fleet Street, working at the Telegraph, writing for the Mail, writing for occasionally for the Sun, and enjoying and appreciating the old Fleet Street traditions and values, and how we did have a fearless and frank press. But that fearless and frank press, certainly as far as environmentalism are concerned, has lost its balls long ago. It has surrendered to the green blob. Yes. And I would argue that all these newspapers bleating about the fact that Extinction Rebellion has been taking away their freedoms, that our print media, and of course the BBC as well, they created Extinction Rebellion by essentially endorsing all its shibboleths, by running endless articles by David Attenborough saying, yes, I have seen for myself that the planet is doomed and there's nothing we can do about it unless we bomb our economy back to the dark ages. Not a single polar bear will survive. You know, it's absolute rubbish. And I do wish that at least one newspaper had taken a stand on this. You know, I mean, back in the day, the Sunday Telegraph ran stories by Christopher Booker. The Mail on Sunday ran stories by the excellent David Rose. That doesn't even happen anymore because they've all been frightened off by a nasty little activist paid by a hedge fund manager. Jeremy Grantham, billionaire hedge fund manager, absolute eco-loon, pays this guy, this pit bull, to complain to IPSO, the Press Complaints Commission, every time anyone runs an article telling the truth about global warming. And they've just sold the pass. They've just given up. They don't want their lawyers being bogged down in these vexatious cases with IPSO. I'm sorry to rant about this, but I feel quite strongly about it.
Well, the thing which struck me as ironic, James, is that the rationale for Extinction Rebellion's blockade of the printing presses.
Yeah.
So what was it? The Times and the Sunday Times. And I think the Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph were collateral damage, and the Sun, of course. Their rationale was these newspapers haven't been yes. printing enough about the dangers of global warming. You know, they've swept this under the carpet because their billionaire owners have a vested interest in raping the planet. We don't think we're stopping people from finding out the truth. We're stopping people from being lied to, because that's all these newspapers do. It was as though you were the editor of the Sunday Times and not, yeah. you know, not the you know, the global warming kind of hand-wringing, knitted-browed worrier, Emma Tucker. I mean, it was extraordinary. It's like, what world are they living in that they think the mainstream media is not on their side and hasn't been kind of banging the global warming drum for at least 25 years? I mean, it's just sort of extraordinary. But it's part of, I think, there's a sort of vanity about not just Extinction Rebellion, but also Black Lives Matter, that they're these real rebels, that they're outlaws, that they're tilting at this kind of the ranks, the massed ranks of the establishment, who are against everything they believe in, everything they stand for. It's as though the establishment hasn't changed in the last 75 years. And, you know, and it's still a bunch of, you know, old white Tory men who hate women, hate minorities, want to rape the planet, would bring back slavery if they could. And it's only these brave young freedom fighters who are tilting against this kind of fascist monolith that can save us.
Which is why
what they don't, I mean, but it's like, hang on a second, you know, everyone in the civil service, every permanent secretary virtually, has put a kind of BLM symbol at the bottom of their emails and has paid fealty to BLM and XR's philosophies. Everything they're promoting is now being promoted energetically across government, across the civil service, you know, by the BBC, in the mainstream media. They are the establishment. It's you know, and you can see that when the police turn a blind eye to these protests. You know, XR can blockade printing presses, stop newspapers, Tory newspapers supporting the government from being distributed. Police do nothing. They don't do. They stand by and purr contentedly, watching these you know, these young rascals, you know, let off a bit of steam, you know, blocking traffic, making every commuter's life a misery. Not that there are any commuters. You know, similarly with Black Lives Matters, they could, the demonstrators can deface the statue of Winston Churchill, our greatest ever prime minister. Please get down on their knee and applaud, virtually. You know, the idea that the British police are kind of, you know, the kind of paramilitary arm of this fascist establishment trying to oppress these demonstrators, put them down, is ludicrous. As soon as someone like Piers Corbyn comes along and you know, and complains about the restrictions on our freedom embodied in the coronavirus regulations, the Coronavirus Act, he's arrested and fine £10,000. You know, it's clear who's on the side of the establishment and what the establishment believes in and what it doesn't. The idea that XR and BLM are these anti-establishment rebels, they are the establishment. The anti-establishment rebels, like it or not, are Piers Corbyn.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And the thing I really don't understand is, if you or I went into a bank and stole, say, $5,000. I think it's highly likely we would face imprisonment, wouldn't we? And yet, when Extinction Rebellion, the cost of policing Extinction Rebellion's protests last year alone were estimated at $16 million. But you think about the economic damage they did to those newspapers. How much must it cost when you deny the Sun, the Telegraph, all the other papers they blockaded? How much economic damage must they have done? That's a form of theft. I do not understand why they are not treated like criminals. Because there's a world of difference between the rather innocent, sweet protests that have been so far been put on about the, you know, the anti-lockdown, anti-masks, you know, one or two cranks worried about 5G and stuff, but a lot of ordinary, decent people just concerned about loss of freedoms, but protesting harmlessly in a limited area. Whereas Extinction Rebellion gets to close down two or three London bridges, gets to spray paint private property, gets to deprive newspapers of their income, and yet they get treated with kid gloves by the police. I do not get it. And then what's Priti Patel, the Home Secretary's response? She tweets out about how it's intolerable. Well, maybe, Priti, you should find out who the Home Secretary is and badger him or her into taking some action rather than just tweeting about it.
I mean, I think it's what's really going on is that essentially, you know, the most privileged class, the educated bourgeoisie, they've decided that they really care about these two causes, about global warming and about
racism,
black lives, anti-racism. Yeah. And because the people actually who run the police in the Home Office, because, you know, chief police chief constables, they're all members of exactly the same class. I mean, the police now is a kind of graduate only service. And to get to the top of the police, you have to have kind of not only kind of, you know, probably done a social science or humanities degree at a kind of former polytechnic. But in addition, you'll have received this training from organizations like Stonewall and Gendered Intelligence. And you'll have undergone various unconscious bias training and diversity training. You know, you will be, to all intents and purposes, ideologically indistinguishable from the XR and BLM protesters in front of you and protesting. They are the new establishment. They're pushing at a completely open door. I mean, there was a good example of this, and you'll notice that, you know, the vast majority of the BLM protesters, the XR protesters, are privileged, upper middle class, mostly privately educated white people, who are kind of, they present themselves as these kind of rebels on behalf of victim groups and the oppressed. But actually, very few members of victim groups, very few historically disadvantaged minority groups actually participate in these protests. If you see the pictures of the XR protesters, you think, hang on a second, they've got a diversity problem. They're all white, you know, apart from the ones that paint their face pink or blue. And this is a good example of this, James. There was a BLM protester, a young lady called Clara Graeber, who was arrested. At least they arrested her. This was in New York, so New York's finest arrested her. She was part of a mob of BLM protesters in Soho, in downtown New York, on Friday night, went on a kind of window smashing spree. So they were chanting, every city, every town, burn the precinct to the ground. You know, the and she was one of them, and I imagine she was absolutely typical of this crowd, wanting to burn the fascist police precincts to the ground and smashing the windows, not just of banks and chains like Starbucks, but of, you know, mum and pop grocery stores run by, you know, first generation immigrants who've probably risked life and limb to come to America to give them and their children a better chance in life. Ordinary working class immigrants in New York City trying to make a living. They smashed their windows, destroyed their shops, destroyed their livelihoods and their children's futures. And the people doing it were people like Clara Graeber. Okay. Her mother, Virginia Kindred, I'm reading this from the New York Post, runs Kindred Arch Works, a Manhattan architect firm that's designed spaces for Columbia University and NYU, worked on numerous school and business spaces throughout New York City. Her father, Marcus Graeber, is an Upper East Side child and adolescent psychiatrist who teaches at the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry. In 2016, the family paid $1.8 million for their 16th floor Upper East Side apartment, and they also own a 1730 home featuring four fireplaces in Litchfield County in Connecticut. That's their country place. So it's people like this, members of the 1%, America's plutocratic, meritocratic elite. Their daughter, who incidentally went to the most selective, hardest to get into Tony school in New York City, Hunter College. It's people like her, upper middle class, privileged, pampered, every want and need catered for from the very first time she arrived on this earth. It's people like her that are smashing the windows of hardworking, poor immigrants who are just trying to make ends meet the name of helping the oppressed. I mean, it's essentially a conspiracy by the ruling class to make poor people's lives even more miserable, all under the banner of helping them.
But the good news is that there are more poor people than there are 1%. There are more middle America than there are 1%. And I hope that middle America realizes that it's got to come out en masse for Donald Trump to frustrate the crooked postal votes, which I'm sure the Dems are even now preparing. I mean, have you heard this terrible rumor that's going round that although President Trump is going to win on the votes on the day, then you're going to get all these postal votes coming through, which have been completely rigged, and he's going to end up losing the election because the Dems have rigged it. And that could lead to, well, I mean, it could lead to an awful situation. It could even lead to civil war. That's my worry.
Let's hope not. Let's hope Trump wins an absolute landslide.
And I agree.
The result is just incontestable. Anyway, yes. I think we need to hear from our sponsor, James, the always reliable Bambi. So when running a business, HR issues can kill you. Wrongful termination suits, minimum wage requirements, labor regulations. And HR manager salaries aren't cheap, an average of $70,000 a year. Bambi, spelled B-A-M-B-E-E, was created specifically for small businesses. You can get a dedicated HR manager, craft HR policy, and maintain your compliance, all for just $99 a month. With Bambi, you can change HR from your biggest liability to your biggest strength. Your dedicated HR manager is available by phone, email, or real-time chat. From onboarding to terminations, they customize your policies to fit your business and help you manage your employees day-to-day, all for just $99 a month. Month-to-month, no hidden fees, cancel anytime. You didn't start your business because you wanted to spend time on HR compliance? Let Bambi help and get your free HR audit today. Go to bambi.com/London right now to schedule your free HR audit. That's bambi.com/London, spelled BAMBEE.com/London. Now, James, what have you been? You've got a recommendation for us, have you? The Karate Kid TV series.
Yeah.
I haven't actually seen it.
Have you watched it?
My 15-year-old son said, "Dad, you wouldn't like it." I don't know why he said that, but yeah, what's it like?
Well, it was originally made for YouTube, but now it's come out on Netflix, and I think Ralph Macchio, the guy who played the Karate Kid,
yes,
must have acquired the rights to the original movie series, because you see footage from the original, you get right. flashbacks to his childhood, and they are clips from the movie.
Right.
And the blonde kid from the evil Cobra Kai karate class plays his adversary in this, they've both grown up.
Is it the same actors?
Yes, the same actor.
Oh my God.
So Ralph Macchio is now running some sort of car firm in the valley. And the other guy, the blonde guy that he defeated in the end, is this kind of washed up alcoholic who's got issues with his son, and comes back and revives the Cobra Kai karate school. And it's great, it's funny, it's got that slightly shonky quality of the movie. It captures the aesthetic of H's movies, so it's slightly cheesy but knowingly cheesy.
Okay.
And it's funny and likable, and it contrasts the attitudes of kids then when you just whip people's asses, whereas now they're all worried about issues like gender sensitivity and so on. I recommend it.
Oh, it sounds quite good. So I have been watching season 2 of The Boys, which finally debuted, I think, on September the 6th, or maybe it was a bit earlier. But it's really good. I had heard a rumour, possibly from you.
I apologise for this rumour.
That it had taken a kind of hard woke turn.
Yeah.
Like many series when they go to season 2 do. But this one hasn't. Season 2, if anything, is even less woke than season 1. It's riddled with this kind of wonderfully refreshing cynicism. So there is a kind of the kind of superheroes they recruit a new female member called something like Stormfront. Okay, maybe that is a reference to Der Stürmer, because she is a bit of a Nazi. But she and the other kind of female superhero have to promote this kind of girls get it done message. So they're kind of promoting this sort of corporate feminism through Vought, the kind of Marvel-like corporation that kind of owns them. And it's played entirely for kind of cynical laughs. You're not expected to take this kind of corporate feminist kind of propaganda remotely seriously. It's presented as just, you know, cynical, a cynical marketing gimmick. It's very good, very good. Highly recommended. Even more violent, if that's possible, than season one. My 12-year-old loves it.
What's not to like? Political incorrectness and extreme violence.
Yeah.
My kind of thing.
No, it's really good. Highly recommended. Anything else to recommend? I've seen Ted Lasso. I'm still liking. I'm gonna move. I think from 7.5 to 8 out of 10 for Ted Lasso, which is just to remind you, if you have forgotten, James, it's about this woman who inherits her husband's beloved football club in a divorce, which is billed as AFC Richmond, doesn't exist in real life, but it's supposedly in the Premier League. And in order to spite her husband, because she is so angry about the bimbo he's run off with, she wants to run the football club into the ground. So she hires this kind of motivational American gee-whiz Southern football coach called Ted Lasso, played by, I think, Jason Sudeikis, to coach the team, because she thinks he's just going to make a complete hash of it and they'll get relegated and it'll destroy her husband, who loves this team more than life itself. But of course, in the course of the series, she gradually warms up to Ted Lasso, and his kind of hokey kind of there's no I in team kind of leadership speeches gradually begin to get through to these kind of vainglorious rich and pampered footballers. It's pretty good.
I haven't got another TV recommendation, but because I've been on holiday in Greece.
Oh yeah, tell me about coming back on the plane. Were you trying to devise some diabolical method to avoid wearing a mask?
It was quite interesting, actually, Tobes. On the way out, because we were obviously, as anti-maskers, we were very worried about being oppressed with muzzles. On the way out, the British Airways crew were very relaxed about it. You know, once you'd sort of walked down the aisle and sat in your chair, they weren't really going to police you very much on whether you wore the mask or not. On the way back, I got through the Greek police checkpoint. I don't like wearing a mask unless I absolutely have to. So what I did, I wore it round my chin below my mouth so that I could breathe. And I wore it as an experiment past the police post. And they were, even though I was liable to a 150 euro fine, I mean, if you don't wear a mask in Greece, that's the deal. The police just didn't react, and that was good. But then I got onto the plane, and the steward, the head or the purser, was very insistent that I pulled my mask not just over my mouth, but over my nose as well. And apparently what had happened, in the interim, there'd been a story in the papers about some flight from a Greek island from Zante to Cardiff, when 5 or 6 or 7 maybe people were infected, and so the whole plane had to be quarantined, and some of the passengers observed that the very poor mask discipline and very poor social distancing being observed. Although quite how you observe social distancing on a plane, I do not know, when you're sitting kind of 6 inches away from the person next to you. And so then there was this ridiculous moment where we disembarked from the plane, having sat obviously cheek by jowl. It was a packed flight, because Greece was rumoured to be next on the quarantine list. The tannoy announced that when we disembark, we'd have to maintain our 2 metre social distancing. It's just a nonsense. So on the one hand, there was this kind of Nazi-ist behaviour. On the other hand, if you wanted to, which is what I did, you can make a packet of crisps and a bottle of water last 3.5 hours. I've done it. You just nibble them very, very slowly.
Yeah.
And so they can't really stop you, because you're eating and drinking, and you don't need to wear a mask for that. And that's so you've got this sort of schizoid attitude. On the one hand, you must wear a mask under all circumstances. On the other, yeah, but if you wanted to eat or drink, it's fine. You can put it down. You don't need to wear it.
It reminds me, it just shows that there's no sort of underlying logic to the kind of mask wearing at all. It's just, you know, it's all about compliance, isn't it, and control. I published a really good postcard from Disneyland Paris on lockdownskeptics.org today, from a young mother who went there with her daughter. And they were hoping, you know, they're worried about a second lockdown being imposed in the UK, hoping to get, you know, a little fun before that happened, before schools close again, you know, fearing the worst. Let's go to Disneyland. At least my daughter can have a bit of fun for the weekend. And she said it was just a nightmare, a dystopian nightmare. She calls it Dystopia Land. And first of all, there's the Mouse Gestapo. You know, they've pulled in these kind of there are police everywhere, making sure that everyone is wearing a mask at all times, and that there are no kind of no exemptions. You know, you have to show a doctor's certificate to an official at the park, and they give you a special wristband, and only if you've got the wristband can you take the mask off. Otherwise, mask on at all times. The only time you and you know, if you take it off, you get shouted at by either, you know, a member of the Mouse Gestapo or someone who actually works for the theme park, or a member of the public, because, you know, they don't want any free riders because they're having to do it. I think everyone else should do
so
it.
So you're
too.
Saying don't go to France?
Well, don't go to Disneyland Paris. It just sounds like an absolute hellscape to be avoided at all costs. She said not being able to see her daughter's expression on the rides or anyone else's. They're not even allowed to go and you know, shake hands with the characters like Disney and Pluto and Minnie Mouse. Sorry, Minnie, Mickey, Pluto, etc. They're all like in these cages, in these Perspex cages, kind of waving away, but you can't get within kind of 10 feet of them. And if you try and take a selfie of yourself, kind of with the character, kind of standing in front of the Perspex box, if you take your mask off, the mouse police are on you straight away.
Oh, really? What, the mouse attacks? Can you imagine the nightmares you'd get? And being attacked by Mickey Mouse.
Well, I don't think Mickey Mouse doesn't, but they're like a Mouse Gestapo are kind of watching you at all times. And if you, but you are, but the completely pointless and arbitrary exception is that if you, they don't want to kind of lose out on all the money they're making from selling the overpriced popcorn and the overpriced soft drinks. So you're allowed to buy them, but you can't take your mask off completely to eat them as you're wandering around the park. You have to keep it on your chin. And if you remove the mask from your chin, you get escorted from the premises. It's like, it's so ridiculous.
Just before I leave Greece alone, can I just give a big up for the Greeks? They're fantastic, really welcoming, and not... Because somebody said to me, I've got this holiday booked for Greece for a month's time, and I'm so worried about the mask thing that I'm thinking maybe I should cancel. No, anyone considering a late holiday, go to Greece. It's really good. They're even though the...
But James, seven of the islands, including Santorini, have now been placed on
the
red list.
But Tobes, not the mainland. Okay, so you go to the Peloponnese, which is what I did, and I reckon they probably won't close it down. But they're just relaxed. You don't have to wear the mask. And it's great. It's like summer holidays used to be. We know in the days when
Sounds
we
good.
Could afford Mediterranean holidays.
Sounds good, James. All right.
Yeah. Good.
Good to talk to you, mate.
Yeah, likewise.
And till next week.
Hmm. Okay. Till next week. Bye.
Bye.
To all who come to this happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land. Here age relives fond memories of the past. And here youth may savor the challenge and promise of the future.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.